This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 369 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This week, we'd like to thank co-producer Aaron A. Stay tuned to the end of the show, and we'll tell you a little bit more about what a co-producer is and how you can find out more. And also, there are still a number of spots on our Pod Abroad 2021 trip for next September. You can find out more at podabroad.com.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along, beginning part 6 on the mountain with chapter 40 entitled Bird Spring.
So we have another date. This chapter starts, it is spring, but it is in March 7, 1774. Claire is awake and hearing the sounds of spring, and she's lying with Jamie, and she hears the snore of Major MacDonald, who is across the way, whom she calls, quote, another harbinger of spring. Since apparently he refuses to visit in the winter. I mean, I guess it's not about refusing. It's about probably it's not very possible to.
Would you?
Probably not very possible to go up those passes.
I wouldn't visit them in the winter at all. One, it's cold. And two, the snow may make passage there impossible.
Impossible.
I mean, I don't know how high up. I don't know how high up in altitude Fraser's Ridge is. That has never been specified by Diana Gabaldone, to my knowledge, other than her saying it was kind of near Grandfather Mountain, I think. But other than that, I'm like, I don't know how high Grandfather Mountain is, and we don't know where, in relation to Grandfather Mountain, Fraser's Ridge, the fictional Fraser's Ridge, actually is. So I don't know how snowy it is in winter and whether or not it's worth it.
So MacDonald had arrived the night before and was probably one of their first visitors, and thus a person bringing news, first way of them getting news since autumn. Because they're both kind of just coming awake and MacDonald's still snoring, so they're like, yeah, fine, let's go for it. So they do it. And then they hear MacDonald waking up as they're getting ready to get up, and they're all now ready to go down for breakfast.
Now we're going to, you're just totally glazing over Greased Lightning.
Oh, no, that was the next line. So Jamie has been talking to Bree, okay. And we find out that he had learned the phrase Grease Lightning. And of course, the phrase existed already before the musical Grease, but that was the first time growing up, that was how I learned that phrase. And and it means speed.
It was definitely popularized.
Yes, that's true. Claire tries to, he uses it very, it's very funny. He's very cute. But Claire tries to say, like, whoa. Like, you know, slow down there, homeboy. It's not about how fast you can. It's not about how, like, powerful you can be. It's about speed. So.
And apparently it's all about almond oil.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe so. And as they get dressed to go downstairs for breakfast, he tells her he'll have to soon go to the Snowbird Village. And it seems part of the news that MacDonald had brought the night before was that the new governor of North Carolina, Governor Josiah, I think it's Josiah Martin, who was asking for help from anyone who would listen. He has been losing grip on the colony. And he's one of his considerations, or his things, like, he's grasping his jaws, right? He's trying to keep his grasp, whatever it is, or, you know, get control of the area. He's considering arming the native populations, or at least some of them. So why? And all this information is coming from letters. And Jamie was like, why is he publishing these letters? Like, that's potentially dangerous information. And he wasn't. His mail had been intercepted, and they're being published without his permission, of course.
For sure. And this is a very difficult time for Jamie, because he is struggling with when.
That's next chapter.
When do I come out as I know it's the next chapter, but that it feeds into why this is so difficult, because he's being asked to be a double agent by the people who want him to do stuff for the crown, even though in his heart and in the way that his daughter and his wife have lived in the Americas and how they know it's going to come to pass, he knows he doesn't want to be on the losing side again. So if he has a choice, being on the right side and the non-losing side, that's where he's going to be. So he's in this really difficult predicament where he has to play both sides. And I know it comes up in the next chapter, but I'm talking about it now because now is the time when they're talking about the gun selling to the Indians. They're so interwoven. You try to stop me when I go ahead, but the point is these two chapters are so combined for me because of it's the beginning of what he's being asked to do, and the next chapter is how is he going to accomplish it? And it happens in these two chapters.
So we find out that Fergus is spending more time at home, which is, of course, better than not. And he's earning some money teaching Hiram Crombie French. The latter now wants to preach to some of the native tribes. Or I don't know if preach is the right way. He definitely wants to preach, but he wants to, I guess, I don't want to say
he wants to convert them.
Yeah, that's the goal. But I don't know if you don't convert by learning a language. You talk to them and you get relationships and you try to convince someone before you can convert them or get them to convert.
He wants
an inroad. Yeah. He wants an easy way to communicate.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You can't communicate. The thing is if they don't speak English and you don't speak the only other language that bridges the two groups, then you will never be able to talk to each other.
Well, also the onus is on the person who wants to do the thing.
You have to find a common language.
If you want to do the thing, then it's not their job. First of all, that's a whole other discussion of whether you should reach out. That's, I know we're not talking about that. That's not this kind of show. But yeah, the person who wants to do, who has this thing, whether it's to convert people, to do whatever, to get customers somewhere, whatever it is that you're trying to do, if you want to change someone's heart or change someone's mind and you are going to be the one who has to do the communicating or the outreach, that is all on you. You have to build the infrastructure. You have to build the, and that part of that infrastructure is communication, and that's on you. So 100%. I mean, yeah, it's kind of funny. We laugh at it, but
absolutely.
It's him. And then they, I'm guessing, apparently all go enjoy their breakfast. Then kind of.
Yeah, after Mrs. Bug yelled at everyone.
Yeah. And then we get a scene change. Roger is assisting in the digging of the pit, or I don't know if he may have done it all, but at least this point, we know he's at least helping out right now. In digging the pit.
I'm pretty positive he's been doing it the whole thing. I think that Brianna was like, I need a pit. And he's like, get me a shovel. And then he employed what Jemmy and German to however he pronounces
to take the
French
dirt
name,
away. Yes.
Employed them to empty buckets for him.
So he's assisting in some capacity with digging this pit for the kiln, the upcoming kiln, the kiln pit. And his assistants are Germain and Jem, and they have been. He would scoop up the dirt or dig up the dirt, whatever, and then take it up and put it like on the ridge on the edge of the pit. And his assistants were supposed to take it away and go dump it, and I guess bring back the empty buckets. Well, they're gone. So who knows? Who knows where they are right now?
They're in a tree.
Jamie probably
don't fall,
so.
Germain.
Jamie comes over and sees him, and he's admiring his shovel. And we learn that it's another one of, although yes, Roger is definitely familiar with 20th century and maybe 19th century. I don't know how old, I don't know when the design or the closest design for the modern, meaning our contemporary shovel was done, but our shovel may be bought. I can go buy a shovel today in 2021 and that shovel may have not changed much functionally since either the 50s or the 1850s. Like, I don't know.
They didn't really describe the current day implement other than that it was made of wood.
He said it was like a shack on the end of a stick. Not a shack.
Right, but it was wooden.
It was a hoe, I think. And he said the modern hoe, their hoe of that time was a... like a pole or a stick with
really
like a shingle on it, like a wooden shingle on the end. It was really kind of pointless to have it. So he's admiring this shovel that Roger's using.
is it a, because there are flat shovels and there are pointed shovels. I'm like, what kind of shovel did she have made? I would hope that she picked out the pointy nose one if you're digging.
She would not have had anything made that wasn't going to work. And if he has gotten it to this deep, it's working. So my guess is it's not. I mean, I guess you could have a sharp, you could have a flat but pointy, or I should say a flat but sharp, and you can have pointy but sharp. So he's admiring the shovel. And it is an idea from a later time, meaning, like I said, we don't know exactly what, we know that the latest shovel Roger and Bree would have seen were in the 1960s and or early, 70s, I guess. But we don't know when even that shovel was most recently redesigned. So anyway, it's definitely a later shovel. So it was put together by the blacksmith, Di Jones.
In these two chapters, they talk a lot about Brianna's innovations and her attempts at innovations and her trying. So, I mean, it's, and they talked about, I was seeing that the video that came out, I think it was Christmas Eve or right around Christmas Eve, the Merry Christmas from Outlander or whatever, that had Kate, Sam, Roger, and Sophie in it. Did I just call him Roger? I did. Richard and Sophie. It had the four of them all looking at costumes and stuff and kind of talking about the season to come. And Sophie was talking about how you're going to see a lot more of Brianna making, what is it? Like engineering feats, like creating new things and innovating in the time period when she shouldn't be innovating because it is all pre-established innovation timelines. But so it's good to know that they thought enough of that to make that something worth leaving in for the adaptation.
And it's during this scene that Jamie asks, like almost with no segue, Jamie asks Roger if they might go back. and of course, meaning forward to their time. Roger's honest. He says that they have thought about it, but that the bridge was home, and he had said it before, and they meant it. But Jamie predominantly is asking because of this impending war.
Yeah, this scene will not be in next season because they already tried to go back and failed.
Roger had said a year ago that they'd stay, and Jamie says he thinks he might have to sell. So this is actually, there's not much segue, but actually what he just said is kind of a segue, or at least leading up to a reason for why he asked them is because of what he's about to say. And that is, he thinks he might have to sell one or more of the gemstones, which could or will potentially affect their staying or going, or at least having the flexibility or privilege of making that decision. Having multiple stones at least provided a sense of security. So why would Jamie have to potentially sell something now or right at this time? Well, this chapter and the next chapter, like they all really kind of, these really were, and it was not on purpose, I promise you. These two really go well together as far as they're like a nice little envelope together. So Jamie, there's Jamie, and again, forgive the title. This is a period appropriate, or I should say appropriate, yes, but a period correct title. But Jamie, as the Indian agent, he has to fund this himself. Like there might be some outwardly,
I hate that,
perceived benefit or status of being an Indian agent, but there ain't no, that's all it is. If there is any status, that's all it is. They are not helping him out at all.
It's right. But think about how shitty it is in this circumstance, because he 100% knows that whole side is going down. It doesn't last. It's the thing that starts the war, right? So it's like those two factions, the revolution in the Revolutionary War, we know that England doesn't win. And that's being the case, he may never see this money again, ever. That gemstone that he has to sell, he may never be compensated for it. And that's what sucks about this. It's like, I feel the same way about my partner is a general contractor, and he has to foot. Now, granted, he gets agreements from his clients that they will pay upon completion, but paying upon completion means that he has to front all the money, which means, you know, he has to make sure that he has money enough to start a job. So it's not just, whether or not he can physically do the job. It is whether or not he has enough money to do the job on behalf of the client, and which she hopes will pay him when he's done. So I can totally, I felt very strongly on Jamie's behalf when I was reading this, because I was like, that blows, because he has to do it or else he has to give up his land. And he's already stated, I'm not giving up the land. I'm not going to sell the land. The land is to him the most important thing. So I'm not going to sell the land. So I have to sell the gems because I'm not getting rid of my land. And I get it. Fine. But that being said, he now has to put forward his own quote unquote wealth to be able to continue to look like an Indian agent on behalf of the crown.
I'm saying that's only part of it. That's only part of, like, this was already true before he made this decision today, right? Or that day, whatever. He's been an Indian. He's been an Indian agent for at least a season now. Like, it was before the winter because, right? No, they didn't do anything in the winter because everything's locked down.
No, it was probably the spring of the previous year, because Claire was kidnapped and raped and the malting shed was destroyed all in between the last time McDonald was there and current.
So he's already had the burden of having to foot the bill for his travel, anything he gives to the Cherokee as in any largesse he gives, like, he's footing that bill. And as Summer said, the promise, or quote unquote promise, that is made McDonald tells Jamie, and Jamie's like, right. We'll see it when it happens. Mm-hmm. But he does, you know, McDonald is the one who communicates to him about being an Indian agent, and he says, and you will be well returned or whatever, you know, by His Majesty. And there was no date given, but it was like, and you will be reimbursed at some point. But yeah, there's very, very little likelihood that's ever going to happen. So he's already had the burden of having to do whatever he needs to do to function in this role as Indian agent. Gifts, whiskey, all this stuff. The Hodgepile gang had destroyed. So it's not because Claire, and I know you're not saying this, but it's not because Claire was abducted and raped that he now has more things he has to supply. No, it's because in the process, before she was raped, they came and destroyed the season's whiskey and destroyed the shed. So there was no surplus to trade or sell. Plus, don't forget, rich goblins are not alone. Hence, we have rich goblins. Otherwise, I wouldn't have differentiated them from anyone, right? 22 more new tenant families to care for. And not just feed, but the whole point is, like, you teach a man to fish, that kind of thing. He has to keep them alive long enough so that they can learn how to survive on their own. So that's a whole other burden. And McDonald, apparently he, fun times, has arranged. Well, he hasn't arranged. He's asking Jamie to handle it. He has basically been a yes man and said that, of course, I will have Indian agent Fraser arrange for the purchase of 30 muskets. And then there's the dowry he's promised Lizzie and the money. And this is Summer's favorite part. She loves it when I mention her. The money he owes Leary. There's so much that he has to be responsible for now, money-wise.
They didn't destroy any whiskey. They destroyed the chance of making new whiskey. It was not, they did not purposefully, the whiskey hadn't been made yet. I just want to make sure that it's clear that they did not destroy whiskey. They destroyed the chance of having whiskey in a future date because they destroyed the mash. They destroyed everything.
Yes, they were trying to find, they wanted to go to the whiskey. That's why they were there. And the whiskey is not kept there. The whiskey is kept
right,
in
but
that
they took
place.
Whatever whiskey they could find, they took. And they were pissed that that was all there was, which is why they destroyed their future earnings, if you will.
Through what they did and the burning down of the malting shed and all the grain and everything that was destroyed, they had nothing to finish the whiskey making process for the entire season. So that is the equivalent of an entire season's worth of whiskey. The money you could make was gone. They lost that opportunity because it was that place and the things there were destroyed. Yes, it wasn't finalized whiskey because it was in the middle of being made.
No. And then again, I don't know how much they destroyed. So I don't know if they need to build a new still. I don't know if they need, you know, what we know that it definitely stymied the forward momentum of their whiskey business. But I don't know if they not only need to build a new malting shed,
that's all they mentioned. Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, that's all they described was the shed itself that was actually in the process of being rebuilt at the time of this of reading this chapter. That's what it said. But yeah, it's not good. So it's not just him being an Indian agent. He's got a lot of stuff going on, plus 22 more families. Like, oh my gosh, like so much. And it's now overwhelming, you know, to the point where his only choice is to sell.
Yeah, that's the frustration for them, is that they physically have enough to sustain themselves, but it's not just them. They have to worry about all of their tenants. They have to make sure that all those tenants who just arrived can make it through until their own harvest. And until they have their own harvest, everyone is relying upon, you know, the owners of the ridge who they are tenants of. So they have to not just worry about whether or not their bellies are full, but he has to worry about all of the tenant farms and make sure that they all have enough food. Because if they don't have enough food, they won't be able to ever pay him. So it's like that, you know, landlord problem of, I need to make sure that everyone here survives long enough to repay me. And if I can't do that, I'm never going to be repaid. I'm never going to get ahead. And this is going to be something I'm always behind.
And so that is why, although he could totally do it without saying, or he's not asking for permission. He is just saying, are you guys like, where do things stand now? And we all know to a certain degree what's coming in the future. But right now we have these things, and I'm responsible for this. So even if you guys are going to stay, well, if you leave, that's a whole other conversation. But even if you guys are going to stay, I want you to know that while your quality of life will not be affected too much by what I'm having to do, the comfort, the at least the mental comfort, or the idea that the feeling of security might be changed if we don't have many or enough gems any longer. So it's not a quick and easy like out of jail free card that they maybe once had.
No, and you also have to remember how hard won all of those gemstones were. So selling all of them or any of them, I'm just like, brutal, man. They are to her rape, they go back to Roger going back on the ship and stealing the thing which kept him away from them for so long. They go back to Ian being kidnapped, which led them all to the New World anyway. So I'm like, these gems, it's not just like, I have this really pretty stone. Every stone they own is connected to something horrible. So also as for Roger, it's not so much that he or Bree and Jemmy are planning to go back, but it's the idea that they know they can. And if they don't have the gemstones, they no longer have that security, totally takes something from them. So it changes. I think personally, it would change for me the way that I interacted with everything in the 18th century.
Not that you shouldn't be careful already, but like, God forbid, I hurt myself in some fashion. Like, there was always that, oh my gosh, if she...
No, yeah. But think about it. If I took the DeLorean back to the 50s and I had a DeLorean and I always knew that I could go back to the, you know, 80s, who cares what I do? I'm leaving. I have a way to get out of here. But if I show back up and I break my DeLorean when I show up and I have to, and which he did, and he had to find a way to get the DeLorean fixed, he had to figure out, not only do I need this to work, but I need to go find the guy who created it and help him remember how he made it in the future so that we can move forward. But trying to get those types of gems or any type of gems in that time period, I'm like, that's a lot. They don't have the money to buy gems. The only way they're ever going to come across gems back then is to steal them, barter for them, or hopefully maybe dig them out of the ground, come across them. But it's not like you can just go down to your local jeweler and find and buy gems inexpensively.
So for now, Jamie says, and he's telling Roger, he will send one stone with Bobby Higgins to Virginia to Lord John. He trusts him implicitly and knows that even if he could do it himself without raising suspicion, Lord John would absolutely be able to get a better buyer or a higher price.
Well, I mean, he knows what circles, like his circle of
aristocracy. I'll get there someday. Aristocracy.
He runs in different circles.
Oh, gosh.
He runs in different circles, and the circles he runs in have more money, which means by default that he can get more money because they have more money. Whereas trying to sell a priceless gem to somebody who doesn't have money, I mean, you're not going to get
anything out
of it. It's not
just getting, like, you know, knowing people who have more money so then you could get more money for it. It's not just that. It's also knowing the people he knows who happen to have more money also know the quality. And this is no shade toward anyone who, like, even like myself, doesn't know this from that with gems or anything. But someone who has money doesn't guarantee anything. But the people that he knows who have the money probably have, or at least someone in their circle, in their family, they know of jewelers. They're going to know of people who know high quality gems. And even if Jamie went to someone in, I forget the name of a town, but a coastal town there that had New Bern, whatever. I don't even know if that's coastal, but goes to a town, a big city for that area, and finds, like, the only gemstone person. What do you call them? Jeweler in 500 miles, right? Even if he finds someone who has the connections, the money, whatever, the fact it doesn't even necessarily mean matter who Jamie is or who he isn't, but the fact that he goes, the guy who is in the middle of nowhere, you know, basically, who is the only jeweler there for miles and miles and miles, may have the exact same knowledge and skills and abilities as someone in London or wherever. Right? Or Philadelphia. The thing is, if you are not in that type of larger metropolitan area for those times, you don't have to, you're going to be like, look, dude from the backwater or back mountains, you're going to take what I give you. You can't go across the street and go to someone else and say, you know, I need to sell this, right? No, on the one hand, he wouldn't do that. He's trying to do it, like, on the sly. So he's not going to be like announcing this. But yeah, Lord John will be able to get more money.
He'll be able to get more money, and he also won't get any questions.
Correct.
Because if somebody from the backwoods showed up with, like, fancy, fancy stuff, they're like, you shouldn't have that. Who'd you steal that from?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's
whereas it wouldn't be surprising at all for Lord John to have
stuff. No, I don't think I don't think we've gotten there yet. And this is not a spoiler. I mean, it's not a spoiler of any kind of story. No,
sure?
It's not a storyline spoiler. But later on, I think, because we haven't had it yet in these two chapters. So maybe it's in our next set of chapters. But when he actually, or maybe it's already happened. Maybe it happened during that talk with Ian, young Ian, when they told young Ian about all the stuff. In that conversation, or what comes from that conversation, they show Ian, if I'm not mistaken, some of their jewels. And the way they show them to him. And we find out that one of the places they store the jewels is in candle wax, which is brilliant. Like, I want to do that. Any hoozle. Yeah. So, they don't show us now, and it may have been from earlier, but, I was just going to say that is actually something. I don't have gems to store, y'all. So this is not like I have anything to do. I could put little doohickeys in there. I don't know. But, that's a pretty smart place to hide stuff. I listened to, was it a podcast or a movie or something I saw or listened to.
That makes me think of those secret candles,
those gift candles.
That have, like, jewels and stuff secreted inside of them. I wonder if that's where they got the idea to start their businesses.
Oh, I see. Well,
I'm going to hide this ring in there. It's worth either $10 or
$1,000. Oh, that's funny.
No, but I mean from that practice. No, I don't think they got it from out there. They might have. I don't want to put it past them.
Something that I watched or heard recently was about, I don't know what the topic was, but I remember what I heard. So there was a woman who was, I don't even think she was a Jewish woman, but she was a woman who was, I don't think she was Jewish, but she ended up in a concentration camp somewhere. And I don't even think it was in Europe. I think it was in, I don't even know. I can't say that. Like, I can't say where, but she was jailed or imprisoned. And, she had, some kind of skill. So, you know, she worked somewhere in the camp she was in. But, when she, was it that Netflix show, Repair Shop. So I think that's where I saw it.
Repair shop?
I think so. So people bring in their priceless heirlooms, you know, whether they're expensive or not, they bring them in because they have some kind of meaning, and the people there help them restore them. It's not usually to sell. It's usually because they have some kind of family linkage to it. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, this woman who was maybe it was Europe because this is in the UK. So she was, or at least in England. So this woman was in a concentration camp and she basically wore the same clothes. I don't know if she was able to take them off and wash them. I have no idea. But the reason I say that is because she had, when they knew trouble was coming and they had, a little bit of time to prep all their stuff, like obviously they can take expensive things with them, even if they had them. She sewed a pocket watch into like a really nice one, like gold and everything, into one of her layers of clothing, like her dress or her, not a shift, but you know what I mean? Like a slip or something. And that was in the late 30s or early 40s. And it stayed in there all through. She wore those clothes or kept them with her all throughout the war. And after the war, she went back to New York. No, after the war, when she went home and then she got married and started a family and everything, she still had it and was able to pass it on to, I think, the gentleman at the show was her grandson. So my point is, whether it's a candle or your or your clothing, people are so, I don't say ingenious, it can be genius, but it's very inventive of ways to hide valuables. There has to be a show out there somewhere or a book that talks about different ways people have hidden valuables, like in candles, in clothing, in bedwear, like, I don't know, a blanket or something. Who knows? Anyway, I found that crazy interesting. So he is going to send one of the gems with Bobby Higgins to Lord John in Virginia to get a much better price than he could for it. And he trusts him too, not to like skim off the top because he don't need it. Lord John's good. He's set. So MacDonald, right about this time, remember, they're having this conversation inside or next to, I think they're at this point, they're both in or near the pit, but they're having the conversation there. And right about now, MacDonald comes out of the house and he doesn't see that the white sow's like not too far from him. And Roger again, in the book, he has very little voice. He tries to yell, warning the major, but his voice ain't so great. The major ran for Roger and Bree's cabin, but he didn't know that, but the ditch was there. So he ends up falling into it and his hat like flies off or stays on the ground and the white sow eats it instead, or chews it anyway. So that's always fun, hearing about the white sow and hearing about the, the comic relief that you kind of sometimes need in these really, in the heavier conversations.
And that was chapter 40, moving right along to chapter 41 entitled The Gunsmith.
So Jamie and MacDonald leave the ridge together and Jamie hangs a left at Coopersville and he's headed to, and MacDonald goes on to wherever he's headed to. Jamie is going to speak with Robin McGillivray, the gunsmith, to talk about those guns. Now, while he's waiting for a break in his work to chat, he notices some of the drawings that Robin has. And he recognizes, like, that's Bree's work. It's for some sort of rifle that can bend in half. Like, right, like, the kind that we see people, like, break open and then put back up together. After talking with Robin, he comes to learn that, no, Bree is not asking to have her own gun built. But she's looking for ways to help improve their build overall. And thus, they're maybe make it quicker to load. Who knows? Just, she's trying to improve it. And Robin knows Jamie's there,
but I love that Jamie looks at it and he's like, it bends. It's got a hinge and it bends in half, which most people would recognize as a modern day
rifle
gun. Yeah. But just imagining to see that for someone who's never seen that before would be like, what the f- why would you do that? Why would you want a gun that does that?
Yeah, it wouldn't make sense at that. I would imagine it would seem just like out of left field. Like first of all, why? And how does it help? Why do that? Why make it more difficult to build? So Jamie is there for a reason. So, Robin sends Heinrich Strasse, his apprentice and soon to be son-in-law, off to get some beer. He's like, okay, go away. And he lays it out. Jamie lays it out. Look, Robin, I need 30 muskets. Boom. And quickly, within 3 months. So Jamie lets Robin think what he wants to about the purpose. He does not go into any more detail. And of course, he can't share that it's ultimately for the governor to arm the native tribes or some of the tribes. And yes, he has cash, he says. Now, Robin says he can probably find 6 or 7, and another dude would make a couple if he were able to tell him who they were for, like, because he knew or trusted or, you know, cared for Jamie. And Jamie's like, I can't because this is my name. You have not heard from me. My name is not attached to this. So Robin says he and Manfred could probably make about three more. That makes a total of 10. So he says he'll ask around, but he'll ask around without connecting Jamie's name with the request. And it's like every other chapter, we learn of another person who fought with Jamie at Culloden and who was imprisoned with him in Ardsmuir. Did we already know about Robin? I don't remember explicitly learning that Robin McGillivray was another one. It makes sense because everyone else is, but I don't remember it. Who knows? So before he goes home, Diana lets us know that he'd ridden Gideon there, but the intent was to leave him there. I think leave him with, if not Robin, someone else, but to leave him with someone, because he'd be help. He'd be basically Jamie's pimping him out. So he's going to stay there and he'll pick him up later. And, so he has to walk the 5 miles home, and he's thinking about his chat.
He was looking forward to
totally.
It.
Totally.
They offered him to let him stay for lunch. And he's like, yeah, I'm good.
So he's thinking,
he's like, and I'm hungry, but I'm good.
He's thinking about his chat with Roger. Regardless of what he provided, the 30 muskets, or whom he was able to influence, maybe three Cherokee tribes or groups maximum, it was unlikely to affect the outcome of the war. So he was happy about that. It's like, if I'm doing this and I'm on this is for the wrong side, it's not so much that it's going to change things. Quote, but he could not escape the knowledge that his own time to jump was coming. Unquote. So currently he was known as a Tory to outsiders or to people who were not basically Jamie, Claire, Roger, Bree, and that's it, right? Oh, and maybe Ian. I don't know how much Ian knows, but Ian probably, I don't know if they told Ian about the war, but Ian knows about the TT. So I won't include him just for now but quote, at some point, this facade must necessarily crumble to reveal him as a dyed-in-the-wool rebel and traitor, unquote. So the question, as Summer said, is when? Now, Jamie mostly worried over the native tribes. He felt like he was knowingly lying to them. I think he's right. He actually was, right? He's not lying explicitly, like not telling them a lie, but working with them and providing them, you know, or I should say, acting as the Indian agent. And he was. But doing that, knowing very well he would not be on that side forever. But he was wondering how he was supposed to suddenly explain a sudden change of heart. Like that is hard. That would be difficult. And then he thinks of Lord John. He's like, oh my gosh, the Cherokee are one thing, a big thing. But it's one thing. They're not like personal friends of mine for decades, right? How do I tell Lord John when the time came? That's going to be even harder.
And not only how do I tell him, but how do I convince him, lifelong English officer, to join the right side and be on the right side of history? How do you do that? And I don't know that you do. We're not there. We're not even there in the story currently in book 8's been out so far. That's what I'm saying. And in book 8, it hasn't actually started yet, really. Like in book 8, we still aren't fully in the Revolutionary War yet, right. That's what I'm saying, is that we haven't asked him to pick a side yet. He's kind of like, well, this is where I am and this is what I do. We have not moved past Lord John being like told, you need to leave the English side if you want to be on the right side of history, and worrying about his friend who is an English officer. So, I mean, that hasn't been resolved yet is all I'm saying.
Not only has it not been resolved, it hasn't even been brought up. I don't think it's going to be brought up because that's linked to TT and that's not going to come up. At least hasn't yet. But, yeah. As a matter of fact, it's not only is not brought up, maybe not because of this reason. I'm not going to say, but there may or may not be a big scuffle between Lord John and Jamie. Who knows? It may or may not have to do with this, but just know it's not all copacetic. So anyway, this one thing stood out to me. You know, it's thinking of Lord John and then thinking, and I'm not even necessarily thinking, I mean, obviously I'm thinking books 7 and 8 and potential seasons. I want to, Summer and I have said, we want all the books. That's not a, I'm not happy about this, about my thought.
I'm not happy about your thoughts either.
But what I don't understand
any
is,
of
I mean,
them, I, like literally any
I
of them.
I understand why for Ulysses' sake, it would be safer to be out of the colonies 100%. What I don't understand is not Ulysses, but for Lord John, they could have wrapped him up with a bow and let him go, to Virginia. Like I just don't, anyway. So to me, to make it that kind of final is, I hope I'm wrong. I'm not giving an opinion either way. I'm just saying this looks like this could fall under that column. That's all I'm saying.
You're not wrong, but I feel like they don't have anything past season 6 greenlit right now. And that being said, they need to be prepared for it to end then. But I can't imagine Starz not re-upping them for more seasons. So I think that it'll be very easy to write Lord John back in and Ulysses back in. So that's a much easier fix than being like, well, crap, now we have to wrap up all the loose ends that we've created by not wrapping them up ahead of time. So I think it's easier to undo what they've done than it is to try to do what they've done a season or two after this.
Yeah, and Lord John himself, okay, regardless of how we feel about how they wrapped him up ish. He features very heavily in books 6, 7, and 8, especially 8, but really in 7 as well. If again, at least the way they're written, right? They may not keep everything. So understand that he may not feature heavily if we do have more seasons. So anyway, as Jamie arrives home, Bree is waiting for him below the ridge. So she's like, she does not want him to get home before she has this chance to talk to him. And she wants to talk to him before he leaves. I think he's probably leaving the next day for the Cherokee villages. She tells him of the Trail of Tears and how in about 60 years time from that year, the new American government or the American government of that time will remove Cherokee from their land to a place about 1,000 miles away. She said she's telling him because some of the Cherokee actually don't go. They went deeper into the mountains and they hid. And she reminds him of what he was able to do after Culloden. At least save the men of Lallybroch because Claire had given him this information. So Brianna is telling him so that he has a chance to at least have the opportunity if he chooses to do it to save more people. So to her, it just didn't seem right to know and not do anything. So she's not saying you have to. She's not going to necessarily, she might be disappointed, but she's not trying to, I don't think she's trying to guilt him at all. She's just like, she felt guilty that if she didn't at least let him know and allow him to decide. Like she was done, right? She had done all she could do, which was to tell him.
Well, she did. And I think that you also have to take into consideration the fact that nobody goes with him when he goes to these camps. So they don't know how personable and personal their relationships are between him and the Indian tribes, the Native American tribes that he's visiting. So because of that, she's like, I don't know how strongly you feel about this, but if you care about these people at all that you've been interacting with, you should know XYZ. And his whole answer is, yeah, that's what government does. And she's like, but that's not what I meant, Dad. You're right. That is exactly what government does. But that doesn't mean that it's right. And it doesn't mean that we as good people shouldn't try to stop it and or alleviate it. And or maybe we're the reason that they hid in the mountains in the first place was because we told them it's not safe. Go hide in the mountains. Because and this is the paradox of time travel. What if the reason those groups of people who stayed in the mountains of North Carolina and didn't go on the Trail of Tears and Dies, what if the reason they stayed was because of Jamie and then no one told him to do it? What if it's the whole cycle and cyclical issue of time travel, and you know, you call it TT, but I call it time travel, and how, what if that's what they did all along? So it's like, what if he went back and did this, and that the reason he did that is the reason she saw it in the first place and the reason she went back? What if she always went back? And what if they always went back? And what if they always told the Cherokee that the only way to avoid this thing is to hide? And the what if the reason those people lived were because they listened? So, I mean, it's that's that paradox of we know if we don't do anything, what if we're the reason that nothing happens?
Exactly. And that exactly was.
Don't ever time travel, guys. It's too much pressure. Too much pressure.
Don't ever time travel. It's too much pressure. That's a good title.
No, don't ever time travel. Too much pressure.
Don't ever TT. It's too much pressure. So he so he just decides, he's like, look, I can tell you what I'm going to do right now. I'm going to go get Jem and we're going to go fishing. That's how he handles it right then.
Mm-hmm. And we're going fishing.
And then scene change. Jamie writes a letter to Lord John. We have another date. It's about a month later-ish. It is April 2nd, 1774. In the letter, he is telling John about his trip to the Cherokee and the Jem, although he doesn't name it as such, because obviously in case his letters are intercepted, he does not want the dude to be accosted, robbed, whatever. So he calls it an item or whatever, but he lets him know that that he has sent something along with Bobby Higgins for him to fetch a price for and sell, and he trusts him and blah, blah, blah. And that's the letter.
That is chapter 41. Join us next time when we will be discussing and continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read along. We will be discussing chapters 42, entitled Dress Rehearsal, chapter 43, entitled Displaced Persons, and chapter 44, entitled Scotchy. I like to pretend they get a puppy and they name it Scotchy. Scotchy, right? And if you'd like to continue the conversation, join us in our online group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Again, a very special thanks to our co-producer for this episode, Aaron A. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon and even what the heck is Patreon, you can find out more at outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you're interested in finding out more about any Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can go to our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.